This episode has been brought to you in part by Audit Shield. Audit Shield is a fully managed solution that helps CPAs across Canada recover professional fees when clients face CRA reviews, audits, or investigations. It's optional for your clients, free for your firm, and ensures you don't write off valuable time. Thousands of CPAs already rely on Audit Shield to protect their clients and their bottom line. With CRA scrutiny rising, it's quickly becoming a must-have.
Welcome to our AJAG PD Pod, the place for discussion, debate, and learning about all things accounting. Our hosts, Ivan Tabak, Jonathan Tucker, are CPAs that have been in practice for more than 3 decades. Together, they bring varying experience and viewpoints to the table, not to mention a little humor, too. Join us as we talk through current issues and hot topics, tap into expert guest insights, and enjoy the odd walk down AJAG memory lane. Before we begin today's podcast, please note, although the educational material within the podcast has been carefully prepared, none of the persons involved in the preparation of the material accepts any legal responsibility for its contents or for any consequences arising from its use. As well, the podcast material and the references contained therein may reflect laws and practices that are subject to change. Advice regarding a particular fact or situation should always be reviewed by a qualified professional. This podcast is produced and distributed by AJAG Professional Development. For more information about AJAG or any of its offerings, please visit ajag.ca.
Welcome back. This is AJAG PD Pod Season 2, Episode 6. And today we're happy to welcome back our first returning guest. Haven't been able to get anyone who wanted to come back and talk to us again. But today we have Avery Swartz, who was a guest about a year ago. One of our first guests on the podcast. So welcome back. Thanks for giving us a second chance.
Thank you for having me back. Yeah.
Avery's a tech expert, an author, a trusted voice on how digital tools are reshaping the modern workplace. So Avery, why don't you tell us a bit about what you've been doing in the past year and give us maybe a broad overview of AI, which was the main topic of our last discussion, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. So I own a tech education company, and that means that these days we are doing a heck of a lot of AI training. In particularly, we train small businesses. And so this year we are working on a national program that has co-investment from the federal government to upskill and support women entrepreneurs with AI adoption. And we're also working on a new program that's going to launch this fall in Northern Ontario to support Northern entrepreneurs with AI adoption. So AI adoption is, I'm, as my teenage daughter says, I'm low-key obsessed with AI adoption these days. I'm just so fascinated with, I have a technical background, so I am very interested just in the technology from a curiosity standpoint. But I'm really, really particularly interested in what's happening in the real world. Like, what are the use cases? What are people doing inside real businesses? How are they bringing AI in? Because it's messy. It's really, really messy. So we're at a very interesting inflection point with AI adoption. And I have a feeling that's probably what we're going to get into today. And even just in the last year, there has been kind of this bigger kind of tipping point. We saw AI on the horizon. We knew that it was going to impact businesses. But even just in the year that since we spoke last, it's becoming more and more of we actually have data that says this. I mean, there was a study done by KPMG that came out in November of 2024. So that's about, what is that, just over 6 months ago, 7 months, something like that. I really am good math. It said that I think it's 46% of Canadian businesses are using AI in one way or another. So I think we're kind of like well past the point of anyone trying to say like we're banning it or you can't use AI on the job. So now it's a case of how are we using AI in a way that's responsible and thoughtful for the business and the individual.
And how and can you, they're using it, but can it be relied on?
That's
and,
the big question.
And how careful are people using it? Are they relying on it when they shouldn't necessarily be relying on it?
Yeah, for me, I use AI as an assistant. It's like I was working with one of my team and it's and I would just be correcting them as they bring me something back, bring me back a document. But I have found where it is incorrect. If you rely on it for an answer, what I am trying to do is localize it so that it has a document to work with. And I say, just in my command, don't just relying on the document I've provided, generate the following.
Right. Right.
So. All right. But like we were discussing before we started recording, it's scary to have documents like that generated, because if you're not writing it from scratch, right, you have to really check every line, every word,
every point,
every fact. Whereas if you start from scratch, the odds are it'll be correct the first go through. So is, you know, it might save you time in drafting the document. On the other hand, is relying on it putting you at more risk of missing something that it generates and that you haven't, because you didn't think of it yourself and put it down on the, you know, on the paper. It's easier to just, you know, gloss over it when you're spot check or when you're checking it. So we started talking about, you know, how could that start impacting insurance claims, insurance rates. Will that ultimately, you know, work its way through? And are there going to be questions?
A series of questions on insurance
on your application? Do you use AI? How do you use AI? Etc. And will it, you know, will it affect rates?
I think a lot about the ways that people bring AI into their organizations, and I think, Jonathan, what you were getting at is a very common flow for people to first start using a generative AI tool. So I'm talking about ChatGPT, Copilot, Google Gemini, Anthropic Claude, those sorts of tools where you're using them to help you with writing. And let's say a relatively low risk task, like helping you write a fairly simple email that does not contain confidential, sensitive information. So
just to that point.
Yeah.
You want to make sure if you're responding to that email that you've first gone through it, maybe in Word, removed any identifying features, and then cut and paste that into AI command.
I mean, let's stick a pin in that and come back to, you know, how do you kind of strip out identifying information, confidential information, sensitive stuff, because that is something that you should be doing. Many people, when they first start adopting AI, they think about kind of like on a task-by-task basis. Like, what is this particular tool going to do on this particular task? And what I encourage people to do is think about their intent for using AI and the impact of that AI use. So why are you even reaching for AI in the first place? And there are certain situations where you would be more likely to reach for an AI tool, and certain situations, like Ivan says, where either just because of efficiency or your personal workflow or because of sensitive information, you might not want to use an AI tool. So first of all, think like, why am I even using it? And then what is my intent for the AI use? Is it efficiency? Is it you know, speed? Is it accuracy? Is it because it could potentially, you know, do something for me faster, stronger, better, cheaper, you know, et cetera. And then you have to think about what's the impact of that AI use. And this is where things get really interesting. Things such as making sure that you are checking it for accuracy, because a potential impact, both, you know, negative impacts and positive impacts, could be, you know, that the data is biased. And so we've got to do a bias check. It could be that we have privacy and security issues. It could be, again, this idea that AI, generative AI tools can get things wrong. It's called a hallucination, which is hilarious to me that that's the term. But it means kind of like making something up. So you need to check for accuracy. And then also there's some other bigger impacts that generative AI use has. There's been some studies recently that suggest that it may actually impact your own cognitive abilities. You start to rely on AI too much, you might become less of a thinker, which I think is a little bit of what you're getting at, Ivan, the idea that people will become sloppy and too reliant on the technology, right?
Lazy.
There's also an environmental impact of AI use, which I think, you know, many people are as concerned as they should be about it. So AI uses a large amount of computational power. Hmm. So when you use Copilot, ChatGPT, et cetera, you are tapping into computers that are in the cloud. So they're, you know, in a data center somewhere. Those computers require a large amount of what in the AI industry is called compute, which doesn't, like, at first I was like, what do you mean it's called compute? Don't you mean compute? Computational or something, but no, they just call it compute. So compute is both the computers and the chips, the power AI technology. That requires a lot of power, like literal power, electricity. And then also those computers get really, really hot. So they require a lot of water, which is used in cooling systems. So there is a strong demand on the grid to power these systems, which of course has an environmental impact. And then finally, of course, another huge thing many people are concerned about is the impact on the workforce. So you've got to be kind of carrying all of this stuff in the back of your mind, even when you are using, you know, ChatGPT, Copilot, et cetera, to help you draft a simple email. All of that stuff is there, and you're trying to balance that intent and that impact.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So many issues, eh?
Yeah.
I was at a tax conference recently, and I asked the person sitting next to me who is from one of the national firms, so what's happening with AI? And he said, oh, no, we're not allowed to use AI. We got a memo from head office saying we weren't allowed to use it. And I thought, that's kind of naive.
Yeah.
It's kind of naive because people are using it whether you realize it or not.
Yes. And so, absolutely.
Right. But from a national firm's perspective, figuring that, a lot of it, they're doing public companies, et cetera. Can you imagine, at least at this stage, them relying on AI for audits and analysis and what they're doing? The exposure that they have of letting something go through. Can you imagine if the information they're generating is going into annual reports investment analysts are relying on it. And
one of the things you can do that I found, I mean, I'm kind of feeling my way forward in this using this, is when I will type in a command, I will say, provide your source so I can check this. Or something like that. So I will actually get, and then I could drill down into that link and say, okay, is that actually factual?
Yeah.
That's another way. And the other thing for those that are watching, a firm policy on using AI, right? Mm-hmm. So, and for those that are watching, we have a sample AI policy. You asked if it was AI generated. It actually wasn't. But anyway, for those that are watching that want to take a look, then feel free to write in and request it. Jason, good to see you.
Great to be here, Jonathan.
So from what you've seen at Audit Shield, how is the CRA's use of AI affecting things?
Well, the usage of AI tools at the CRA are making reviews a lot smarter and certainly more frequent, especially as compared to about a year previous. And they're using their AI-driven data analytics to flag your discrepancies, you know, very simple, unusual patterns, and your high-risk filings when they're doing this all at scale. What's interesting, of course, is that the tools can cross-check thousands of data points in seconds. So even the smallest anomaly is being flagged, whereas in years previous, it may not have even been noticed.
And so what's that mean for CPA firms?
Well, simply put, more of your clients are being flagged, even those that have so-called clean records. You could say that the reviews are often more detailed, requiring more extensive supporting documentation. And of course, it's your time. We're certainly seeing an increase in the amount of time spent in having to respond by the CPA to the CRA.
Right. So where's Audit Shield fit in?
Well, simply put, we're your safety net, right? Because we make sure that 100% of your time responding to these disruptions and CRA scrutiny is covered by us. So 100% of your professional fees are covered by Audit Shield.
Yeah, that's important. Jason, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, there's a URL on the screen, and certainly my email address is jason@accountancyinsurance.ca.
Great. Thanks so much, Jason.
all of these things are the types of things that are now, like you say, what's the risk?
Yeah.
What's the risk? So,
and I think, you know, when we say AI, artificial intelligence, that is a huge and very broad area, right? So AI, just like the actual definition of AI, is a computer system that can in some way replicate at least a certain level of human intelligence or a degree of intelligence. But inside the world of AI, there are so many different types of artificial intelligence systems that we need to be, I think, a little bit more specific about what types of AI we're talking about, in what tools and in what applications. So, for example, Jonathan, you say that it's naive to think that you're not using AI. Yeah. We've all been using AI every single day for at least 15 years. AI is what powers spam filters in our email.
A Google search.
Yes, and there are, now there's this thing called AI overviews in Google search, which is a whole nother thing. But AI powers algorithms. So if you're literally, on Netflix trying to figure out or what YouTube TV show you're going to watch, there's a lot of AI under the hood in that. AI powers Google Maps and, you know, how you can get around. So there's lots of different AI that we're using under the hood. There's even AI that's baked into our regular software long before generative AI came out. And generative AI is the type of stuff like ChatGPT and Copilot that creates or generates something new. So, for example, there's been AI technology inside Microsoft Excel for a long time. You wouldn't necessarily know it's AI. You don't even need to know that it's AI. So it's like when people say, oh, we don't use AI, it's like, well, do you turn on a computer? You use AI. But I think what they're really getting at is saying we don't use generative AI.
So if I'm using Word or if I'm using Excel and I'm doing calculations, is any of that information becoming public? I'm working on my spreadsheet on a client.
Okay, so now we got to like go for like massive disclaimers, which is I don't work for Microsoft.
Yeah.
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm definitely not a data security specialist. But what I can tell you is that if you are using, let's use Word, Excel, Microsoft 365 applications, you, especially if you are using Microsoft 365, which is a cloud-powered platform, then the cloud, what it is it's literally data on your that you see on your computer, but it's stored on a computer somewhere else.
Right.
It's going through the internet to a computer in a data center in the Midwest or something. So is that secure? By its very definition, no.
Yes.
That will never be truly 100% lockdown secure.
Yeah.
The only way to make data 100% truly lockdown secure is to have it not connected to the internet on a local server, you know, in a bunker, you're not, you're completely off the grid, et cetera. So there's, it's mitigation, right? It's harm reduction. It's on a scale. And when we look at generative AI systems and how secure their data is, this is where, like, everybody, and this is something that, you know, like CPA Canada, CPA Ontario could be doing at scale for the entire industry, but there needs to be a really strong understanding of the terms and conditions of the different tools that you use.
Absolutely.
Right.
There's now, we're starting to see tools that are going just beyond general use, like Microsoft, now into tax research.
Yes, I'm sure.
I was looking at one recently, and so I had my IT person look at it who came back and said, well, firstly, you ought to know that the data sits in the U.S.
Yes.
So we get into Patriot Act.
Yes.
And how that information may not be available if things change.
Yes.
So would never have thought of that.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yes. And in this particular moment of Canadian sovereignty. Wait, how do you say that word? Sovereignty. That's sovereignty, the word I'm looking for. Yeah. I always stumble on that one. But in this particular moment of Canadian sovereignty, a lot of us are also thinking about data sovereignty.
Yeah.
And where our data actually lives.
Well, that was an issue when you and I in our practices have looked for, okay, if we're going to use online storage, where are mine's in downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
I know it's in Canada. That was an absolute deal breaker for me.
Mm-hmm.
So these issues now are really becoming all the more important, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have a few AI companies that are Canadian, like born and bred in Canada, live in Canada.
Their equipment resides in Canada.
Yep. Yeah. But the big one, so Copilot, made by Microsoft, of course, and it integrates really nicely into your 365 environment. Also, you know, ChatGPT, owned by OpenAI, Gemini, which is made by Google. Like, these are all American companies. Yeah. Now, they do have Canadian offices, but if you were to type into ChatGPT right now, odds are you are probably communicating with a data server that's based in the U.S.
Right. So just jump back to the Excel and Word issue.
Yeah.
So we're using the online versions of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm preparing an Excel spreadsheet and I type my client name and my client data.
Yeah.
So because I am using the actual software that's residing somewhere else, that's exposed. Then I save the file and now that file itself resides on my computer.
Yeah, if you're saving it locally, sure.
Right. We'll assume that.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So now I've got custody of that file.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's just the instance of creating it and saving it. Mm-hmm. It existed somewhere else for a while. And does that image reside? I guess it depends if they're saving it or not, right? Or recording.
But when you're creating that, sometimes you're actually like auto save is on and it's saving it in the cloud somewhere. You haven't actually created it.
Yeah, well,
the saving onto your machine is kind of the last step.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so many of us don't even save to our machines now. We save our documents in OneDrive or SharePoint, you know, which is in the cloud, because that also, I mean, these are this is always like a risk reward judgment call, right? Saving to the cloud is kind of convenient because heaven forbid, your laptop breaks or something. So you've got the version back there. But also it allows for collaboration.
Right.
So if you have an Excel sheet that is saved in OneDrive, you can collaborate with your coworkers because it's in the cloud and everybody can access it. Yeah. Clients. Yeah. Also, when we're using, you know, email or online portals to share documents with clients, with colleagues, et cetera, all of that is facilitated by cloud technology. Now, I mean, again, I don't work for Microsoft and I'm not a data security specialist, but Microsoft definitely has a stellar reputation for having best in class cloud security. And it's something that, you know, they've literally built their whole brand on in terms of being very, very reliable.
But you would think that, and maybe this exists and I'm just not aware of it, but a question when you're signing up for these services, it says, where would you like to store this? In other words, what jurisdiction would you like to store it? Store this
and
just
some companies
as a license.
Do. Yeah. Yeah. They will literally ask you, you know, where do you want your data stored? And now you are seriously bumping up against like the limits of my knowledge of exactly like, because I can't remember the last time I, you know, but it is all technically there for you to see. It is in the terms and conditions. It is in your policies. It is in the licensing agreement that you have that we all just scroll through and click, fine. When we're signing up for a new platform.
What have you come across? I was talking to one of my former co-op students about 2 months ago, and she's off working in a fairly well-known financial, banking institution. And I was saying to her about how I could confine my data. And she said, why don't you just get your own private LLM?
Yeah.
Know anything about this?
Sure. Okay. So where should I begin? What do you know what an LLM is? Should I start there?
Let's talk to those that are watching. What's this acronym mean?
Okay. LLM stands for Large Language Model. And this is inside the world of generative AI that you will see this phrase, Large Language Model. So we know what those three words mean independently. Large means big, language, literally language, and a model. And this is something that CPAs, I think, will have an instant understanding that other members of the general public won't. You understand what modeling is. You do modeling all the time. Mm-hmm. So take the idea of a modeling system. In the context of generative AI, and what a large language model is it is a computer system that has been what's known as pre-trained. And pre-trained means that a body of knowledge, and in the case of the LLMs that power ChatGPT, that power Microsoft Copilot, the power of Google Gemini, those LLMs have massive, massive bodies of training data. And so that training data is, in most cases, it's pieces of text. So it could be literally kind of like the entire internet. It can be a bunch of books. It can be a bunch of articles. It can be knowledge from an organization, manuals, how-tos, procedures, etc. It's all fed into this machine. And to keep it as, I won't get too technical, but basically the way that an LLM works is that it looks at the body of data and it kind of chops it up into small pieces. And instead of looking at the data to try and understand what it means, what an LLM does is it looks at the data and tries to understand the relationships between the pieces of data. So if you think of another tool that looks at a big piece of data, think about Google, like the search engine, right? Mm. So when Google uses computers to search the entire internet, what it's looking for is the meaning behind the words and also the relationship of the internet itself. It's known as like the web, links that go to different places. An LLM is not looking at the meaning of the words. An LLM is looking at the relationship between the words. It breaks them up into small chunks known as tokens. Then that model usually layers, it has a chatbot layered on top of it. So that would be the chat part of ChatGPT or the conversational part of Copilot. And when you interact with Copilot or ChatGPT, what you're asking it to do is to do something known as probabilistic-based prediction. Mm-hmm. So what you're asking Copilot to do is to look into its model, its knowledge of the relationship between all the words in its training data and predict an answer for you based on probability. So, okay, let me give you an example. I'm gonna start saying a sentence and I want you to finish my sentence, okay? It's raining cats and...
giraffes.
Oh, come on.
Dogs.
Yeah, right? Okay, or how about better late than...
never.
Right. Because in the body of training knowledge, there is a probability-based likelihood that if you start a sentence, it's raining cats and... probability says that the next word should be dogs.
Right.
There might be some instances where giraffes right. is actually the answer, but in probability, it's more likely to be dogs. So it's a predictive model that predicts the next piece that should come next. That's how generative AI works. It's a prediction machine. Right. So using kind of what your co-op student said to you was, build your own LLM.
Yeah.
It's because a lot of the problems with the large language models that power ChatGPT, the power Copilot, is that the data is muddy. It could come from copyright protected sources. You may have heard about how some artists and authors have had their work, you know, stolen and fed into ChatGPT and those kind of systems. You may have heard about there's a lot of bias. There's it's known as algorithmic bias, where the inherent values of a society and of a culture are baked into a robotic
right.
system.
Right.
So a system might be more likely to be racist or sexist, you know, et cetera, because the training data is right. racist or sexist.
Right.
So if the idea is, OK, let's use our own training data, then it would be more reliable and more secure.
Still has a potential for hallucinations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the reason for hallucinations is based in that very borderline, almost too technical explanation that I just gave you of how the probabilistic systems work. They will hallucinate. Right. They will always hallucinate right. because there will always be a probabilistic chance that the prediction is wrong.
Right.
And that's how hallucinations happen. It's not like the AI is the Terminator and wants to kill you. Yeah. Like it's not trying to trick you or yeah. be rude or mean or anything like that. It's because sometimes the data is muddy yeah. and the probability is not right. So yes, you can still absolutely have hallucinations if you train on your own data. The other challenge with training on your own data is you need to have a large enough body of data
right.
for it to be able to find those relationships amongst the tokens.
Right. So in the conversations I've had with people since then who've been in these larger organizations, they're the ones who are saying, yeah, well, we're developing our own LLM.
Yeah, sure.
And so then I went to my IT guy and said, I want my own LLM.
Yeah.
And he said, well, maybe you don't need that.
Right.
And
right,
so,
right. Yeah.
And so he said, but you definitely want to be thinking about how you're using AI, because some of your information that you're putting, if you just use the general version of ChatGPT,
yes. Yeah.
And you're not on a subscription based, then whatever you put out there is fair game. And so that's why he took me through and said, all right, here's the version of, in this case, ChatGPT that you need to be using. That will mean that is as secure as it can get.
Yes.
Under that license. And you need to be thinking about that, not just for yourself, but for your staff as well, who are all using that, because they're not logging into AI or OpenAI, right? They're just using it, the free version online.
Right, right.
So it's the free version that will absorb the data. And throw it into the pool.
Well, okay.
But if you have your subscribed version,
no.
That keeps it private.
So this is where like the devil is in the details, right? Okay. So I actually wanted to add something onto the last point, which is you can run a local large language model that could be trained on any data.
Mm. Your own server.
Yeah, on your own server. Yeah. You can literally run your own version of a chatbot that is completely local and doesn't like phone home. You can download ones. It's fairly technical to be able to even get it set up. You can actually take an existing large language model and run it locally.
Right.
You can run kind of like a local version of ChatGPT just on your own computer. It's a bit technical to get it set up. Yeah. You need to go and get what's known as an open source model. And if you're interested in kind of puttering, and it gets pretty technical pretty fast, but the place where you're going to get it is an open source AI community website repository called Hugging Face. Okay. It's a silly name, but that's where there's a lot of AI and open source AI models where you can go and grab one.
Yeah.
But okay, devil's in the details on the exact specifics of your different licenses with tools. So if you have, there's a version of using ChatGPT where you don't even have to log in. You can just go to chatgpt.com and start a conversation. Yep. No account at all. In that situation, yes, it is as secure as sending a postcard in the mail. Anybody could read,
right.
You know, what you have. So the content of your conversation, I don't even think you can upload files in that version, but your conversation itself goes back to OpenAI. It's fed into the training data for future models. It's a bit of a nightmare for data privacy and security. You can have an account on ChatGPT, and you can have a free account, and then you can have different levels of, individual account, teams account, enterprise level accounts, etc. Even on the free account of ChatGPT, you can go into your settings and you can turn off the, I think they call it something like, allow the model to benefit for everyone. It's very vague language, but basically what it is if you read the fine print, it says, if you have this toggled off, then we will not take information from your conversations and feed it back. But that being said, at all levels of ChatGPT, even the enterprise level, so like the very expensive one, et cetera, and this is a very strange thing that is true as of when we're recording this right now in July of 2025. It might not be true in the future. ChatGPT and the company that makes it, OpenAI, they have to preserve the content of every conversation that everybody has with their chatbot, regardless of what level of tiered membership you have, because of a lawsuit that they're undergoing right now. So the New York Times is suing Microsoft and OpenAI for alleged copyright infringement in the training of their large language models. So the court has ordered OpenAI to not allow for the destruction of any data while that court trial is going on.
That's crazy.
Right? Isn't that weird? It's such a weird little side note from a court.
Massive.
Right? It's a massive burden. It's an absolute huge burden in terms of data collection and data retention. But what that's like, now let's talk real, like plain speak.
Yeah.
Do not put anything into a chatbot that you would not want leaked on the internet.
Yeah. That's why I say move if you're going to use it. Put it into a Word document, although maybe Words, maybe it's a local version.
Sure. I mean, you're doing the best you can.
And strip out any identifying features.
Yeah.
and then cut and paste that in and work away.
Yeah, whenever possible, remove any identifying data. Take your client names, email addresses, et cetera,
which can be just as time consuming as actually thinking about the whole thing yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that gets back to Ivan's point. It's like,
Do it yourself.
Yeah, I was looking at a will the other day, and so I went through and took out all the names and then uploaded it. The other thing just to mention is when you upload those files, they don't stay there long, right? You upload it, but then if you go back to it later on and you try to work off of it, it'll say...
I've noticed that myself recently. It'll say, like, I'm having trouble accessing that file. Can you send it to me again?
And according to my IT guy, he said that's part of the security is just not leaving things there for a long time in terms of those attachments.
Yeah.
So, but again, I just think just assume that it's going to fall into the wrong hands and make sure it's clean, right?
But that being said, I mean, I think there is a large amount of our day-to-day tasks that could be done with the assistance of generative AI that don't necessarily touch that stuff. I mean, we don't have any AI laws in Canada right now. We do have a new AI ministry, and rumor on the Hill is that there will be some AI regulation probably within the next little while. But we do have a Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act, or PIPEDA. So any AI use has to, of course, be in alignment with that as well. Yeah. But that being said, like, you know, you don't necessarily have to use generative AI to, you know, use all of your client data or any, you know, really big tasks. Well, you can use it for smaller things.
One of the things that I've thought of lately, which is just to see if we can mine, is our inbox.
Sure.
Get it. Or our outbox. We get a lot of repetitive questions from clients. You know, can I write off my car?
Yes.
Or I'm thinking of buying a new car. And so what am I? Yeah. And I would just love to be able to have my own contained LLM just to say, go through my inbox and put together an email based on what I've written to clients before.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to achieve that, right? And not go out any further than just contain it within my inbox or my staff's inbox.
Excellent use case, Jonathan. Yeah. Anything that relates to customer service, you know, client services in that way, you know, kind of frequently asked questions. There's nothing personal or, you know...
Well, you're containing it in your own...
About, can I write off my car? Right. Like, that's a commonly asked question.
The problem would be that the person that I've written that email to before or all that. Yeah. So that's why I want to contain it in one place.
Right.
Locally, if I could.
Yeah.
Right. But again, all the data in all your emails is going to be viewed, it's like uploaded to some extent.
Yeah.
Right. For you to analyze.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm saying if where you're uploading it is your own... drive you're using, right? And say, take that and just apply your chatbot to
that. But that's still being driven by the software, right?
Sure. So
which to be is not residing, right?
Can you get a version of the software that you control so that it doesn't from Ivan's machine to where it's being analyzed? Can we create a firewall. Yeah, or a channel that's secure.
Yeah. So one of the things that you can do with Copilot is you can actually use Copilot, the Microsoft chatbot. You can use it in two different modes. You can use it in when you go to, I think it's copilot.microsoft.com, or if you go to microsoft.com and log into your account, and you'll see Copilot on the left. You can toggle it between what's known as web mode and work mode. So if you're in work mode, it's kind of like a firewall. It's only existing inside your company's data. But again, your company's data that is shared and cloud-based. If you put it into web mode, then it's like ET phone home. Like it can then kind of access the internet and a greater area of knowledge. But even like to just take it much more simply, I mean, I know this does require a bit of manual labor, but if you're like, gosh darn it, somebody's asking about their car again. You know, every time that happens, you just like literally just grab the text, the question and the response, the question, the response, the question, the response. Strip it of, like, you don't have to include the date, the recipient, etc. Take a whole bunch of those, just dump them all into a Word document, put that into ChatGPT or Copilot and say, this is a question I tend to get asked often. Can you look through my answers and write a frequently asked questions.
Yeah. So we have a folder now that's just that very thing,
yeah.
frequently asked questions.
Yeah.
Really. And I'll just say, June, just go into that folder and look for cars.
Yeah.
Right. So, but to your point though, I mean, there's still work. You've got to be thinking, all right, am I going to use this again? And is it worth the time to go through
right.
and strip out all the email? And it isn't yeah. just, it's my email. It might be anybody who's copied on it. It might be the client. It's yeah. it's not a small task yeah. sometimes.
And when you think, especially as you know, leaders of organizations, when you're thinking operationally, yeah. and this is something that predates AI, of course, you think about, okay, is this a task that is going to come up over and over and over again? If it's a task that is going to come up over and over and over again, it might be worth the time and investment of building out some sort of standard operating procedure that we're going to do it this way and we're going to, you know, establish a workflow and da-da-da-da-da. And it's kind of like going slow to then go fast yeah. because when you have There's to do it over and over and over again. Yeah. But if it's a task that it's like, no, this is not going to happen again, then we'll just da-da-da-da-da, do it, send it out the door.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same sort of thing.
You know, the other thing I find it helpful with sometimes is if a client will ask about, you know, maybe there's a financing question or something like that. I can put enough information in it and this is the only reason I do it is because it will then give me a trail of its calculations, which I can always check on my own calculator to make sure that
yeah.
the future value or present value calculations are being, but it's so quick. And so then I have that, and as long as it's accurate, then I can just cut and paste that into a Word document, put it in the file, and I've done my work and documented it thoroughly, right? Yeah. Very quickly. And that's where this is a good aid.
Yes. Right?
So, and I think our limitation around using AI is our own imagination.
Oh my gosh. And we are right? at
just remembering,
such...
can I use this for anything?
And we're in such early days yeah. with the adoption of this technology. I mean, I remember the dot-com boom. I remember the early adoption curve with bringing in, you know, why we would use the internet, why we would use computers as opposed to, you know, writing a letter. Like I do remember like writing letters yeah. or typing something up, printing it off and then sending it in physically as opposed to by an email. And it's like, if you can imagine, remember back if you're... I think we're all old enough, but maybe some of the viewers maybe will or will not be old enough to remember in like the year, you know, 1998 to say like 2002, when we were just using the internet for email, for quick, you know, looking things up, and then we would be offline for the rest of the day. If you could tell yourself 25 years ago that you would be carrying a little computer in your pocket, you'd be wearing a little computer on your watch, maybe even in your eyeglasses. These are not smart glasses, but you could be wearing smart glasses. And I could just dip, dip, and it would bring me a car that would pick me up and take me somewhere. Like, yeah. what?
Yeah.
Like, that's wild. Like, yeah. the things that we couldn't even imagine 25 years ago of where we've gone with the internet, I think is like where we are right now with AI.
Absolutely.
But you make an interesting point, Jonathan, about habits, remembering that AI is even there
yeah.
to reach for it over and over again. And that's a key component of AI adoption. Yeah. So we've got education.
Yeah.
You need to know and have some guardrails in place. You have some policies.
Yeah.
But then also a lot of adoption is in building habits
yeah.
and reaching for the tool over and over again.
Our conversation has talked a lot around OpenAI and ChatGPT, but
yeah.
you know, there are other tools. We're talking about tax research, but
sure.
somebody who wants to do investing. All right. Well, what platform should I be looking at that would give me reasonable, would give me accurate, like what of these artificial intelligence platforms are being built for different purposes?
I think that a lot of that exists now
it
with
does.
Some
it
of the online brokers
does.
where
yeah.
you input your risk tolerance and whatever, you know, parameters, and it'll manage your portfolio for you.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what risk?
But
at what risk?
Right.
Again.
And that's always it. It's like the intent and the impact, and how do you mitigate that risk?
But I think the people who are going to be using that type of a feature
yeah.
are going to rely on it probably 100%, right? Because if you had the knowledge and the skills to be able to go in and double check what this
yeah, yeah.
this
yeah.
online management, you know, it but is, then you would probably want to be doing it yourself.
But if you're managing,
I would think.
If right? you're managing your own portfolio, as an example, right? I mean, this could be a very valuable tool just in terms of it and analyzing potential companies to invest in, right? And gathering that data. The question is, how do you, it will gather it so quickly and so much. How do you, like, every point is a potential for error.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's, and there are points that you, just by you looking at it, you know, without you drilling down and fact checking every comment,
yeah,
you have no way to know.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a tax point, you can read it and say, no, this doesn't make
well,
sense.
Oh, hang on, Ivan, because no? We got to get into, we can't conflate that the downside of using generative AI, which one of the biggest downsides is hallucinations and errors. Those do not exist in all AI systems. There are many AI systems that do not have hallucinations.
How would you know that? How would you know ones hallucinate and which ones don't?
Oh, it's based on the type of technology that it's built off of. Okay. But the thing that an AI system can do that a human cannot or could do, but it would just be like just time and energy intensive, is just literally raw computational power. So let's, again, before generative AI, so let's take that off the table for a minute. Let's look at more traditional forms of AI. You may have heard, this is going back a few years. Remember when IBM made that tool Watson, mm-hmm, that could beat everybody at chess, mm-hmm, right? And Watson became this AI supercomputer, mm-hmm, that could play lots of different games. Also, there was a company called Alpha that was eventually acquired by Google, and Alpha learned how to play the game Go. I don't play Go, but Go, as I understand it, is a very complex game and has many, many, many different ways of it being played. But let's talk about chess, because I'm sure you probably know, I'm not a good chess player, but I know the basics of chess. Mm. So the thing about Watson, the AI system that got so, so, so good at playing chess, and this is not generative AI, this is long before generative AI could become a thing. What Watson could do was run scenarios at the speed of light, basically. Watson could run out every single potential chess play. And I've heard, again, I'm not a good chess player, but I've heard that this is what good chess players do. They're always thinking three or four plays ahead, right? Mm. So a supercomputer with artificial intelligence can run every possible scenario in the snap of a finger, to then be able to decide which one to run with. So when you're looking at, again, it's almost like modeling, right? Yeah. That's the type of artificial intelligence that you're applying to markets.
All right. So the other day I was using, on a trial basis, I was using one of these LLMs that's a tax research platform, typed in and said, what's the CRA limit for CCA on a 10.1 vehicle? It came back and said $37,000. I said, it's not 37, it's 38 this year. I wrote in, you're wrong. Please check. Mm-hmm. Came back, said, you're right. It's $38,000.
Yeah.
Right? So then there is a help, like a little chatbot or something, rather.
Yeah.
So I wrote in and said, it gave me the wrong response, to which I got an email back saying, thanks for letting
us know. Sorry. Yeah.
Check it.
Yeah.
to which it said, oh, yes, that is in an earlier version. Now, the time we're shooting this is July 2025.
Yeah.
This announcement came out early this year.
Yeah.
And it said, oh, no, it's only going back to December. Well, late December, CRA put out their thing saying it's been bumped up to $38,000. And it didn't pick it up. And I checked it a couple of times, and it kept giving me $37,000. And it was like, so it's great that it's giving me an answer quickly. It's horrible that it's giving me the wrong answer, and I still have to know. And so that's where it brings me back to, but I've got to manage this thing. This is my potentially tax assistant, or this is my executive assistant, mm-hmm, type role. All right. No, you got that wrong. So you've still got to be using your head when you're using these things. You cannot rely on it, or you're going to get in trouble.
And so the reason why it said 37,000 instead of 38,000 goes back to that idea of probability. There may have been a higher probability in the training data.
But even in the command, I said it is July 2025. I gave all the information and I still came back with the wrong answer.
But really what this gets at is generative AI really does well in situations where you do not need to have a hard fact.
Mm. Unfortunately, in a profession, you need to have a hard fact.
Right.
So in certain aspects of that profession, so let's look at marketing, communications, client services, where let's say you are going to write a, you know, a social media post or a piece of thought leadership on LinkedIn or a blog post, et cetera. There's many, many different ways to write a blog post. Now, there's going to be some facts in that blog post. The facts need to be double checked. Absolutely. But the overall tone, the overall style of writing that blog post could be done almost an infinite number of ways. That is where generative AI really excels and does well. It's when it's the very, very particular fact after fact after fact, that's when it falls apart.
And I think that's why when we use this, we know its strengths and its weaknesses.
Absolutely.
Just like we do with our staff. Right. It's the same. And that's why I keep thinking this is just kind of like another part of the team.
And so, you know, when people think about, you know, is
Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing, I think, because I don't trust staff. So I don't have any. I don't have any.
I'm not using
AI because I don't want to have to be double checking that either.
That's hilarious.
I do it myself. And if it's wrong,
this is also why. You know, Jonathan, I love that you're guiding people towards an example policy, because these are the kind of things that should be in policies, and not only just in policies, because oftentimes in organizations, people read a policy and then it gets kind of shoved in a desk drawer and never looked at again. So we've got to build in the habits of checking if are we adhering to the policy. So it's in your annual, your biannual performance review. How are you?
And you're signing
AI
off on it. Right?
Or we've got to check it back against the policy. Does the policy itself need to be updated? Has it, you know, as the technology changes, the policy probably needs to grow. But, you know, what's the kind of the foundation of any responsible AI use policy is there will always be a human who checks the facts before something goes out the door. And here, you know, here's something kind of fun. Later on, go to Google and just type in, ChatGPT lawyer. And you will find it used to just be one case. Now there's been dozens of cases of lawyers who have tried to do trial research using ChatGPT. And they got their wrists slapped because the model hallucinated and they didn't double check it.
So it's like that it made up cases.
Absolutely.
To justify its own findings.
Wow.
Sure.
That effect.
It created citations of cases. That didn't exist.
Which, again, it's not the machine trying to be malicious. It's just literally hallucinating.
And it could put it in the format so you'd look at it and go, okay, like whoever versus the crime. It has all that information.
Knows how to set it up. So in those situations where it's a fact, it might say, you know, we're going to point to Crown versus Tobacco. Then, right?
Again.
Yeah, I was about to say. Like, maybe, I don't know.
Which year?
Crown versus Turner and Tobacco. You need to go and double check that fact. And Jonathan, you said that sometimes you'll ask it for its source. This is also where people get sloppy. And this is not on the machine. This is all on the human. It gives you the source. Double check. Actually go to the source and see if it's there, because it can even hallucinate the source.
Now, so we've talked about ChatGPT.
Yeah.
We've talked about research tools a little bit. Another area now that I'm finding is becoming all the more available is in our phone calls. Now it's now it's capturing transcriptions.
Yes.
And there's information in those calls. Where's that information going?
I mean, it completely depends on the situation. Okay, so
you and I use the same.
Give me a use case for.
Yeah. I have a phone call and it's automatic. We've got the settings set on to say record the phone call.
Oh, yes, of course.
And so then it gives me a transcription. Or even if you don't have the phone call turned on, it will now automatically transcribe, or like I use it a lot for virtual meetings.
Yeah.
And then it'll just get, and there it is. It's just generating it as I go.
Yeah.
My thought is, where's that information going?
Yeah.
I mean, those are pretty confidential phone calls.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
and it's so convenient because I can have that transcription instantly. But now everything, so you got to remember, do I need to turn this off?
Right.
If I'm in, if I'm in that, because that might be a confidential. So that's my question about those tools, because they're very valuable tools.
Absolutely.
But
and again, it's one of those, like, you know, again, risk reward. I personally use an AI transcription tool in almost all my meetings, because to me, the reward is so strong, because I don't like taking notes. Yeah. And it makes my entire workflow faster. If I have a client meeting and it's recorded, then I can look at the summary. I can immediately move to the action items. I can then follow up with a proposal.
Yep.
You know, it just, the entire thing becomes more smooth. So this is where you absolutely need to be looking at what are the terms and conditions of that tool you're using, and try and do your best diligence to pick one that is, you know, compliant.
Think about your engagement level, where you're putting information like this into, right? It's in the footer of my emails so that there's no surprises. You can't say I didn't alert you to these tools being used, right?
Yeah.
But again, how do we communicate that with our clients in the day-to-day, particularly as this is changing so rapidly?
Yes.
Now, right? It's one thing to have a policy. That's great. That's just the first place to start. Now, where is this technology already being used?
Yeah.
And we're not even aware of it.
Yeah. Right? And like you said, like there's the technology, there's the implications for data privacy. And then there's also this cultural aspect of how do you start a phone call and say the phone call is going to be recorded? I will oftentimes, when I start a video call, I will say to my participant on the call, I'll say, before we get into anything, I'd like you to know that my robot friend is here with us. It is recording everything that we say to provide a transcription for me. I am happy to share that transcription with you if you'd like to see it. I will only be using it for my own purposes for follow-up. And if at any point you'd like me to turn it off, I am more than happy to kick the robot out. And like, that's just kind of my common disclaimer at the beginning of the call.
I had a client the other day who asked me for a copy of the transcript. She said, I said, sorry, these are just my notes. You're welcome to make your own notes, but I don't give out transcriptions.
And that's fine too. I mean, it's your policy. You can do whatever you want.
But that's, I'm just saying to people, that's going to become more of an ask for clients.
They're either
going to be recording you and using their own tool, right? And there's transcript AI and those types of things, which you just record it and then it'll transcribe it instantly and send you an email and say, there's your transcription. So it's already happening.
Yeah.
Right? So just be careful what you're saying. You might be being recorded and you don't even know.
I kind of assume, this is going to sound very paranoid, but not in my home, when in my personal life, but in my professional life. Yeah. I kind of assume I'm always being recorded in some way or another, I conduct myself accordingly.
Yeah, I agree.
I know that sounds very paranoid.
Well, I think it's a realistic assumption to make nowadays, right?
Yeah.
So physicians have dealt with this, I think, longer than we have, because you know, patients go in to see their doctors, and you know, in your bag or your phone's already on record, and and it's just another means of keeping. You're not trying to trap somebody. It's just your way of keeping track of your notes.
Yeah.
Right. So now if you're just going to go back to the old analog phone recorder and put your, you know, do your call on speaker so that it's, you know, so that you have it here. It's not in the cloud. It's not available to anything. And, you know, how else are you going to do it? I mean, it's just everywhere, right? You, your entire life is you're either being videoed or recorded or.
Yeah.
It is hard not to be paranoid, because even our phones are on when we think they're not, right?
Yeah.
So.
It's like my wife is always saying to me, you know, to just, you know, always act like somebody is watching you. Right.
That still didn't help you though.
No, well, that's why she has to keep telling me. She has to keep reminding me. But you know, it's everywhere. And it's so easy to forget.
And I think, you know, especially for CPAs and those particularly in management, you know, leaders of organizations need to really be thinking about all this stuff, because it is happening in your organization, whether you're aware of it or not. People are using more and more technology, including generative AI technology. And if you're sticking your head in the sand and saying it's not happening, then that's, I think in terms of the riskiest behavior, that's probably the riskiest behavior is denial. It's better to at least try and get your head around it and figure out what's going on and set some guardrails.
And our government particularly is encouraging the development of AI, right? It's on their agenda. This is
absolutely.
We had one of our recent podcasts where we're talking about R&D credits around AI.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's here. It's not going away.
Yeah.
So it's just about to be aware of the environment we find ourselves in now.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, the good thing about it is that at least we're all in it together.
Yeah.
Like we're all kind of figuring this out at the same time.
Yeah.
Your entire industry is trying to figure this out.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know that you have some AI courses now that people can take that, you know, that can help you get some of that foundational knowledge.
Yes.
I think absolutely everyone needs some foundational knowledge just about how this technology works. What are some best practices for using it more safely so that we can kind of mitigate some of those risks? And then, you know, to stay on top of it. And that's what I love about your industry, that you have continuing education baked in. There's so many industries that don't, that it's like, you know, you learn something, you know, in your training or in your school 20, 30 years ago, and then that's it. So, you know, to always be continuously evolving and following what's going on.
Yeah. Such an interesting topic, eh? Yeah.
And scary topic.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think I'm glad I'm at the end of the, closer to the end of the line than the beginning, because I don't know. Just...
Yeah.
Mind you, people come, you know, the newer generation coming up is it's just, you know, part of their regular lives. They'll understand it and they'll use it.
Well, just like you said, 20 years ago when technology was coming out to us, when Google and email and all of that stuff seemed like, wow, that'll be amazing how that's going to impact.
Right.
We never looked at it and thought, oh, look at all the risks that could go wrong with it, right? Yeah. But you might send an email to the wrong email address.
Or, mm-hmm.
That could be an example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So
it's fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
It's people often ask me about my job, and I say the one thing is that it's never boring.
Yeah.
It's always changing.
So what's coming up for you now? What's your next projects in this area so people can keep track of you? And how do they get in touch with you if they've got questions?
Yeah. So, I mean, my next project is to take a little bit of holiday this summer.
That's not a project.
Right? But then the fall is jam-packed with training and also speaking. I'm doing a fair bit of speaking. And my in-person training, I get to go to the Yukon. I'm going to go to Whitehorse in October. I'm really, really excited for that. My work takes me to some really interesting places in the country. So
anything you're reading that our viewers might be interested in just in terms of how to incorporate this, or, I mean, we've got courses, so certainly go on to ajag.ca and take a look at our AI courses, but anything you're reading that would be of interest to those early adopters?
There's a couple of people that I follow. So I follow their work that they tend to write and create material. One is this professor named Ethan Mollick. Ethan Mollick came out with a book. It's about a year old now, but it still holds up. It's called Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI.
Still holds up.
It does still hold up. But he writes a really brilliant email newsletter called One Useful Thing. So that's from Ethan Mollick. He's a professor at the Wharton School.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, very, very smart guy. Another person that I follow that does a lot of work at the intersection of business adoption and AI is Allie K. Miller. You can find her by looking for AI with Allie. She has some online courses. She has an email newsletter that's great. She does a lot of free or low-cost offering as well. And again, particularly looking at, you know, that inflection point of the adoption of AI into a business. Mm. Allie's stuff tends to be a little bit more technical. Ethan Mollick's stuff tends to be a little bit more business and... business case oriented.
Okay. And if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm Avery Swartz, and I, you know, I've got that name locked down on the internet. There is no way to look for Avery Swartz and not find me.
Okay. Good.
So I'm actually quite active on LinkedIn these days. So that's a great place to find me. I've also, you know, got my website, company website, and I'm doing a lot of media work as well.
Why LinkedIn? Why? Is there something about LinkedIn?
It's so interesting because if you had asked me, you know, 5 years ago, I would have said, ew, LinkedIn, no thank you. To be quite honest, it was kind of the downfall of Twitter. It's when there's a lot of technical people that were really active on Twitter, and we didn't really like where it's gone. So I left Twitter a couple of years ago and was like, well, where are we going to talk about our business and technology stuff? Like, I'm on Instagram where, it's pictures of my dog.
Yeah.
But for more of a business and technical thing, a lot of us ended up on LinkedIn.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. So it's a place for people to look.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Avery, for joining us again. And, giving us your thoughts and your insights on AI. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you're looking to dive deeper into AI tools or any other PD topic, head to ajag.ca to check our full lineup of courses. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.